question and would not have to deal with the wide-open vista of her answer. "Perhaps you could help me decide," she said. "I'd like to know you better." He remembered her saying, "I am not a young woman any more, so I've decided against a young woman's wiles in favour of a more direct approach." That, at least, was no fabrication. "What would you like to know?"
"Many things, but most pressingly, how and why did you come to be the person you are today? I find it an intriguing mystery."
His heart thudded. "No mystery there. I almost died."
But she wasn't so easily satisfied. "My daughter almost died at age 16. That experience only made her more of what she already was, not a different person altogether, which you, by all accounts, have become."
She raised her teacup and let it hover just below her lips, her wrist as steady as the pound sterling.
"My instincts tell me that I cannot understand you until I know the story behind your transformation, and that your story is more than a man's brush with death. Am I wrong?" He considered a variety of answers and rejected them all. Having enjoyed the privilege of bluntness his entire life, he was ill-suited to suddenly take up prevarication.
"No," he said. The teacup continued to linger in the vicinity of her chin, a shield, almost, a disguise, too, to hide her dangerous perspicacity behind a bit of glazed fine-bone china painted with ivy and roses.
"If I may be so forward, was there a woman?"
He didn't need to answer her question, but then he didn't need to invite her to tea either. He didn't know his plans any more than she did hers, possibly a lot less. "Yes, there was a woman," he answered, "and a man." Her features froze in momentary shock. Carefully, she set down her teacup. Presumably, the stability of her wrist was no match for the excitement of her rather salacious imagination. "Goodness gracious," she mumbled. He laughed a little, with rue. "Would that it were that kind of uncomplicated sordidness."
"Oh," she said.
"You've probably heard about the hunting incident. I was shot, bled profusely, was put into surgery for 6 hours, and barely survived," he said. "But you're right. That in itself had no more life-changing effect on me than a hangover or a bad case of indigestion." A week after Langford was out of danger, Francis Elliot, the man who'd shot him, came to see him. Elliot had been a classmate at Eton, the one whose house in the next county Langford had frequently visited when he was home on holiday. Over the years, their once close friendship had gradually cooled, and they saw relatively little of each other, Langford living fast and footloose, Elliot settling down to be the staid, responsible, unimaginative landowner in the mould of his forefathers. That particular morning, Langford, highly peevish from both pain and ennui, had lambasted Elliot on his shoddy marksmanship and slandered his manhood in general. Elliot held his tongue until Langford ran out of pejoratives. No easy feat, as Langford, trained to be a man of letters, possessed a near infinite supply of belittling words. Then, for the first time in his life, Langford heard Elliot shout. "It turned out that the man who shot me did so deliberately, though he hadn't meant to almost kill me. That was the result of nerves and bad aim, because I'd seduced his wife." Mrs. Rowland had lifted a cucumber sandwich. She went still. He'd shocked her without even getting to the worst part of it. "I had no idea what he was talking about. I'd never met his wife, as far as I was concerned, until I remembered, very vaguely, an encounter at a masked ball given by another friend of mine 6 months previously. There'd been a woman, a young matron with a forlorn air about her. What had been an evening's diversion for me, nothing more, had precipitated a domestic crisis for my friend. He loved his wife. They were going through a difficult phase, but he loved her. Loved her deeply, passionately, if also awkwardly and inarticulately. At first, Elliot's tale invoked in Langford nothing but contempt. He would never let a woman, any woman, matter half so much to him. Any man who did so had only himself to blame for such an idiotic attachment. Then, after his initial outburst, Elliot did something startling. He apologized. Through gritted teeth, he apologized for everything. For his lack of character, his lapse of judgment, for taking his despair out on Langford, when it was his own fault that his wife was unhappy in the first place. Langford, still irked, accepted his apologies with no pretension of graciousness. But after Elliot's departure, he couldn't get the man out of his head, couldn't stop seeing the expression on Elliot's face as he apologized, an expression that held only self-reproach and a determination to do the right thing, despite the avalanche of scorn he was sure to trigger. With this unconditional apology, Elliot had proved himself, despite his earlier action, to be a man of fortitude, conscience, and decency. Everything Langford scorned and despised as too plebeian for his exalted self. "I didn't want to change or be changed," said Langford. "The way I'd lived was a highly pleasurable, highly addictive way to live. I was loath to give it up. But the damage was done. I was shaken. In the subsequent days of my convalescence, I began to question everything I'd taken for granted about my choices in life. How many others had I hurt in my mindless quest for amusement? What worthy use, if any, had I made of my talents and my vast good fortune? And what would my poor mother have thought of it all?" Mrs. Rowland listened with grave concentration, her eyes never leaving his. "What happened to your friend and his wife?" It was a question that still plagued him in the dark of the night. From what he'd learned, they seemed to be fine, with no reports of shameful squabbles or unseemly fondness for the bottle. "I understand they have produced 3 children together. The eldest came along about a year after he shot me."
"I'm glad to hear that," she said.
"But that doesn't really tell us anything in and of itself, does it? A man and his wife could very well procreate in mutual abhorrence. He wanted to picture for himself a family in harmony, but his mind would only paint images of silent, frightened children walking on eggshells around parents locked in a hideous bitterness, a bitterness for which Langford was responsible."
"Marriages are curious things," said Mrs. Rowland. "Many are exceedingly fragile, but others are exceptionally resilient, able to recover from the most grievous injuries."
He would like to believe her, but the marriages he'd known had been, by and large, indifferent. "You speak from personal experience, I hope."
"I do," she said firmly.
"Tell me more," he said. "I demand something at least halfway sensational in return for the divulging of my own unspeakable past."
She picked up her teacup, and then, rather resolutely, set it down again. "Sensational it wouldn't be. The most sensational thing I've ever done in my life was blurting out to you that I wish to marry you. But it should come as no surprise now that I had indeed wished to marry you more than 30 years ago."
It was still a surprise to hear her speak of it so candidly.
"I believed I had the looks, the comportment, and your mother's approval. The only obstacles were your youth and your certain disinclination to marry a girl hand-picked by your mother. But I considered neither insurmountable. When you were done with university, I'd still be of a marriageable age, and in the meanwhile I would educate myself in the classics, so as to distinguish myself from other women who would be vying for your hand. My plan, no doubt, strikes you as both arrogant and simple-minded. It was, but I believed fervently in it. In hindsight, I can see that we'd have dealt disastrously together. I'd have been dismayed by your promiscuity, and you in turn repelled by my sanctimonious meddlesomeness, as my daughter has called it. But in those heady days of 1862, you were mythologically perfect, and I was fixated on you. Needless to say, when Mr. Rowland began his courtship, I was not thrilled with his attention. I craved rank and disdained money made in sooty ways, whereas he possessed nothing but the latter. I didn't understand why my father welcomed his calls, until I did as well. Believe me, having to marry him for such a mortifying thing as my family's ruinous finances did not further endear him to me. There was regret in her voice. Suddenly Langford realized that the regret wasn't for him, but for the long-departed Mr. Rowland. He felt an odd pulse of jealousy. "You mean to tell me your marriage eventually recovered from that grievous injury?" "It did, but it took a long time. When I married Mr. Rowland, I decided to be a right proper martyr. While I refused to lower myself by seeking out your news or succumbing to affairs, I also refused to see him as anything other than a legal entity to whom I'd sacrificed my dreams for the sake of my family. Even when my sentiments finally changed, I didn't know what to do. It seemed ridiculous that I should feel something other than duty and obligation toward a man I'd called only Mr. Rowland for so many years." Her voice trailed off. She finally lifted the cucumber sandwich to her lips again. "We had 3 good years before he passed away." He didn't know what to say. He'd always considered happy marriages to be the stuff of fairy tales, about as likely as fire-breathing dragons in this mechanized age. He found himself ill-qualified to comment on her loss. In the silence, she ate the cucumber sandwich with great daintiness. When she was done, she shook her head and smiled wistfully. "Now I am reminded why polite society does not engage in rampant honesty. Awkward, isn't it?"
"Not so much as it is thought-provoking," he answered. "I don't think I've had a more frank conversation in my entire life, on things that mattered."
"And now we've nothing left to talk about except the weather," she said wryly.
"Allow me to correct your misconception here, madam," he said with equal dryness. "I understand that beneath your facade of ideal femininity, you are a blue stocking who just might be learned enough to appreciate my vast erudition."
"Ooh-hoo, watch that arrogance, Your Grace," she said, grinning a little. "You might find it to be exactly the other way round. While you were out carousing nightly, I read everything that was ever jotted down during classical antiquity."
"That may very well be, but have you an original thought on it?" he challenged.
She leaned forward slightly. He noted, with pleasure, the gleam in her eyes.
"You have a few days to listen, sir?" Chapter 25. The 3rd of July, 1893.
Picnic, capture, light, tree, shadow, purple.
Gigi stared at Freddy's moving lips, her concentration stranded somewhere beyond the Cape of Good Hope. What was he talking about? And why was he speaking so earnestly of such incomprehensible and inconsequential things when barbarians had broken through the gate, torched the bailey, and were about to storm the keep? They were in trouble. They were in trouble so deep and wide that the best alpinists broke down and wept halfway up,
and the greatest sailors turned around and headed home long before reaching the other shore. Then she remembered. He was talking about afternoon in the park, and he was talking about it because she'd asked him to, so that they could carry on a decent conversation, and that she could pretend, at least for the duration of his call, that all was well, that the smoke darkening the sky was merely the kitchen roasting a few boars for the evening feast. She blinked and tried to listen more attentively. 2 days after their return to London, Camden had left to visit his grandfather in Bavaria, but the damage was done. He'd been gone more than a month now, and not one of the nearly 800 hours had gone by without her revisiting their last night together and catching her breath anew at his intrepid offer. Everything reminded her of him. The details of her own townhouse, which she'd barely noticed any more, had suddenly become a narrative of all her once fervid hopes. The piano, the paintings, the Cyclades marble she'd selected for the floor of the vestibule because it matched the colour of his eyes exactly. Had she made the right choice? She knew what it was like to have made an unethical choice. She knew the fear and the corrosive anxiety that bled into and adulterated every joy, every delight. In this instance, she was fairly sure she hadn't come down on the wrong side of the moral divide. But where was the sense of inner strength conferred by the right choice? Where was the peaceful slumber and the clear sense of purpose? Why, if she'd made the right decision, did it feel oppressive and, on some days, palpably suffocating? She gave Freddy permission to resume his daily calls, to silence the gossip that the trip to Devon had generated. Freddy's renewed visits quelled the rumours, but did nothing to soothe her agitation. The rapport they shared was still there, but the sense that they belonged together was becoming as frayed as a 10th-century tapestry, on the verge of disintegrating altogether with the least exposure to the elements. "Freddy," she interrupted him. "Yes?" She broke the moratorium on physical contact that had been in place since the day of Camden's return, and kissed him. It was always nice, kissing Freddy, sometimes even very nice. But she needed more than nice. She had to have something surpassingly ardent, a veritable conflagration, to erase the burning imprints her husband had left on her, to eradicate from memory her response to him, all hungry abandon and desperate need. The kiss was very nice, and she spent the entirety of it thinking of the very person she was hoping to forget. She pulled back and pasted on a smile. "Forgive the digression. Go on, tell me more about the painting." Freddy looked to the door as if expecting to see tweeny maids giggle and then run off with news of what they'd espied. When the corridors remained silent, he leaned forward and tried to kiss her again. "No," she stopped him. She didn't want any more reminders of her vastly different reactions to the two men, or of the fervour Camden effortlessly fomented in her. "We still shouldn't. That was my fault." Disappointment dimmed Freddy's eyes, but he nodded slowly, ceding to her wishes. 309 days to go," he sighed. "I swear the days are thrice as long as they were before." In this, at least, they were in perfect accord. She turned to his art again, since it was one of the few safe topics left to them. "I'm glad, then, you've been able to keep yourself busy. I hear Lady Renworth is pleased with her portrait." Freddy revived a bit at her compliment. "I had dinner at the Carlyles 2 days ago. Miss Carlyle asked me to paint her portrait, too. We'll probably start next week." "It seems she has a high enough opinion of your skills, at least." "Well, she did warn me she would be highly critical if it didn't meet her standards." Freddy smiled a little. "Did you know that she's been to an Impressionist exhibition?
All this time, I thought you were the only person in my acquaintance who knew anything about the Impressionists.
Gigi bolted straight up. Freddy, startled, rose too.
Is everything all right? Is it Miss Carlyle? I should have asked you about it first.
No, it isn't Miss Carlyle.
Oh, if it only were. If only Freddy and Miss Carlyle had been up to some mischief.
It's me. I should have told you long ago. I don't know anything about the Impressionists.
But you have the most marvellous collection I've ever seen.
I bought them wholesale. I bought out 3 private galleries because Tremaine liked the Impressionists.
Freddy looked as if she'd just told him that all 9 of the Queen's children were illegitimate.
But does this mean... were you...
Yes, I was in love with him. I wanted him for more than his title, but I overstepped and my marriage withered on the vine.
She took a long breath.
I'm sorry I didn't tell you earlier. Very sorry. I apologize.
Freddy swallowed, gamely trying to digest the past she'd suddenly dumped on him. Then he cleared his throat, and she tensed.
Dear God, what would she say if he asked her whether she still loved her husband? She couldn't lie to him, not at this juncture.
Yet she could not bring herself to face the truth, could not handle the abject terror of being in love, the kind of love that had already once derailed her life. Freddy looked as conflicted as she felt. He glanced down at his shoes, stuck a hand in his pocket, drew the hand out again, and fiddled with the fob of his watch.
You really don't know anything about the Impressionists?
She didn't know whether to laugh from relief or to weep. Perhaps Freddy loved her only for her paintings. Perhaps he was as afraid of the question as she. She pointed at a canvas directly behind him, a landscape of blue sky, blue water, and a French village with ochre roofs and porridge-coloured walls.
Do you know who painted that?
Freddy turned to look.
Yes, I do.
I don't, or at least I don't recall any more. I bought it along with 28 other pieces.
She touched his cheek.
Oh, Freddy, forgive me.
She stopped cold. Slowly, as if expecting a knife-wielding assassin, she removed her hand from Freddy's face and turned toward the door. Her husband stood there, leaning against the door jamb. Her heart gave a leap of pure, startled joy.
Lady Tremaine, he nodded. Lord Frederick.
Her pleasure instantly decayed into self-recrimination. How could she be so vile? She'd completely forgotten about Freddy, as if he wasn't there, as if he'd never been there. Freddy bowed awkwardly.
Lord Tremaine.
She could return neither Camden's greeting nor his gaze. She only vaguely recalled the time when she'd been dead certain that a divorce was the key to unlocking her happiness, when she'd fully, confidently anticipated putting him behind her once and for all. Why hadn't she seen it? Why hadn't she realized sooner that she had been seeking that one last battle, a titanic clash, one for the ages? And why must Camden have turned everything on its head? To go so far as to suggest that he bore an equal share of the culpability? To ask her if she wanted to start afresh, a new life together? Was he mad? Or was she?
I was just about to leave, said Freddy. Please, Lord Frederick, do not discommode yourself on my behalf. Lady Tremaine's friends are always welcome in this house, said Camden, all gallantry and graciousness. I've had a long journey, if you'll excuse me.
As soon as Camden was out of earshot, Freddy turned to her, half in shock, half in panic.
Do you think he saw us?
No. She'd have known. He couldn't have been there for longer than a few seconds.
You're sure?
Tremaine is no more a threat to my physical well-being, if that's what you're worried about, than you are. Freddy took her hands in his.
I guess that isn't what I'm really worried about. I'm only afraid that the more time he spends around you, the less willing he will be to let you go.
No, it was the other way around. The more time she spent around Camden, the more impossible it became for her to let him go. She patted Freddy's hand.
Don't fret, darling. No one can take me away from you.
She'd made the right choice. She had.
If only the reassurances she offered Freddy didn't sound to her own ears like so much mendacious drivel.
Camden ripped off his necktie and threw it on the bed. He crossed the chamber, rinsed his face, and buried it in a towel. She was touching another man with tenderness and affection. What else was she doing with him? Camden slapped down the towel and caught his own reflection in the mirror above the washbasin. He looked about as happy as the citizenry of Paris on the eve of the storming of the Bastille, primed for violence and mayhem. He dipped a hand in the washbasin and flung a constellation of water drops against the mirror. The drops rolled down the glassy surface, obscuring the face that stared at him in unblinking belligerence. Her obstinacy angered him. To be sure, he'd been too abrupt in proposing a new beginning, but now she'd had a whole month to think things through. That she belonged with him and not with Lord Frederick was so obvious to Camden that he couldn't even begin to understand how she could choose otherwise. His own obstinacy, however, angered him even more. So she'd made a stupid choice. At least it was consistent and honourable. She'd said over and over again that she would swim the Channel in January for the chance to marry Lord Frederick. Why couldn't he accept it? Why did he dream and hope and plot still? He walked to his steamer trunk and wondered whether there was any sense in even opening the thing. He hadn't returned to England on some random date. The Campagna would leave for New York City within the week, and he'd seen enough this afternoon. The image surfaced again in his mind, her hand against Lord Frederick's cheek, the infinite care in her touch. "Oh, Freddy, forgive me," she'd said. And she'd looked at Camden and immediately looked away. Camden frowned. He hadn't thought of it before. Why was Gigi asking Lord Frederick to forgive her? Except for that brief interlude when she'd forgotten herself, she'd been unwavering in her loyalty to him. And Camden couldn't imagine her divulging the intimate details of her conjugal relations to anyone, least of all Lord Frederick. His head remained blank for another minute. Then his world turned upside down. It could have meant only one thing. There had been consequences to their lovemaking. He was going to be a father. They would have a child together. He gripped the bedpost, unsteady on his feet, as if he were drunk on the very best champagne. Child! Dear God, a child! A baby! She'd agreed to his conditions only because she never intended to conceive. He knew her well enough to know that she would not give up her firstborn to marry Lord Frederick. She would stay with Camden and they would become a family. And given their propensity for ending up in bed together, that family would grow. He could scarcely comprehend it. Absurdly maudlin images inundated his mind. A family of his own, full of stubborn, naughty brats with bright eyes and cunning smiles. Puppies running through the house, chubby arms held out to him for hugs. And her, regally, confidently at the centre of it all. It was all he wanted. It was everything he'd ever wanted. He pulled off his travel-crumpled coat and flung open the trunk to search for another. In the back of his mind, he was vaguely aware that this wasn't how he'd wished to be chosen, by default. But he didn't care any more. A whole new life was open before him, and he was dizzy with the possibilities of it all. Goodman entered to deposit a batch of letters and departed with the coat Camden had picked out to be pressed. While Camden waited impatiently for his coat to return, he riffled through the stack of mail. There was a letter from Theodora. Ironically, she'd become a frequent, faithful correspondent after their respective marriages. He'd gone from merely Monsieur to Cher Monsieur, then Très Cher Monsieur, Cher Ami, and now Mon Très Cher Ami. He skimmed through the pages. She was well. The twins were well. The winter in Buenos Aires continued mild and humid. She contemplated moving back to Europe for the sake of the children, now that her husband, may God rest his soul, no longer needed the benefit of southern climes. And in other news, she planned to visit New York late in summer. She'd be delighted if he would call on her. She had missed him greatly these past 2 years. Not long after Theodora married her Grand Duke, they relocated to Buenos Aires for his health. Most winters, June, July, August, they travelled to Newport, where they kept a house. Camden was usually too busy with his ventures to join the summer circuit for long stretches of time, but he occasionally sailed up, attended a few functions, and called on her with presents for Masha and Sasha. He liked to see her and the twins, but not this summer. Something far more important and wonderful would keep him in England for quite a while. Something called fatherhood. Goodman returned. Camden shrugged into the newly pressed coat and wound a necktie about his collar. It took him a minute to realize the butler was still hovering about discreetly, waiting for Camden to address him.
"What is it, Goodman?" he asked, knotting the tie.
"Her ladyship would be dining at home this evening. Would your lordship be joining her?" asked Goodman.
Camden paused.
There was something different about Goodman's tone. It was almost wistful. Where was that quiet indignation Camden had come to expect, that sense of righteous reproach on behalf of his mistress?
"Yes, I would," said Camden.
He was home at last. He would never leave again.
She didn't hear him as he entered the back parlour. She lolled on a chaise longue, cocooned in a gown the colour of the Mediterranean at only a few feet of lucid depth, her head tilted back, her eyes lashed to the 8-foot-wide plaster medallion at the centre of the ceiling. He rarely saw this side of her, still, almost drowsy, languorous and voluptuous as a nymph on a sultry spring afternoon after a night of bacchanalia. The half of her skirts trapped under her weight pulled at the layers on top, tightening the spread of taffeta about the roundness of her hips and the mouth-watering length of her legs, long enough to connect Dover to Calais. He feasted on her, drinking in her somnolent sensuality. But all too quickly she perceived him. She swung her unshod feet off the chaise and sat up straight.
"You look well," he said.
His compliment took her aback. Uncharacteristically, her hand crept to her coiffure and tucked a tiny escaped strand of hair behind her right ear.
"Thank you,"
she replied, her tone almost diffident.
"So do you."
That was not a bad beginning.
"I apologize for my earlier intrusion."
"Oh, that. Freddy was just about to leave."
"Did you tell him?"
"Tell him? Of what?"
He blinked. She didn't sound coy. She sounded baffled. She was not pregnant. Suddenly he felt unsteady again, this time as if someone had swung a very large object at the back of his head.
"Nothing," he said. "Nothing."
He walked to the grandfather clock and pretended to check the time on his watch.
when he wanted to grab the poker next to the grate and smash everything in the room. The children they were going to have, the life they were going to share, everything slashed and burned in a vicious assault by reality. And her, oblivious to his pain, throwing away their happiness as if it were last week's bread. For a while, as he wound a watch that needed no winding, nobody said a thing. Then he heard her deep breath, and knew, from the way his heart suddenly splintered, what she was going to say. "There are no consequences," she said. "Will you let me go?" Every single cell inside him screamed no. He would most certainly not let her go. In fact, he was feeling downright nostalgic for those terrible old days when a woman had no choice whatsoever in those matters, when he could laugh cruelly, hang Lord Frederick by his ankles in the dungeon, rip her chemise to ribbons, and have her right on the dais of the Great Hall under the scandalized eyes of the local bishop. The period they'd agreed to was far from over. That she refused his entreaty did not release her from the conditions he'd set. That every touch would be fraught with peril did not diminish the allure of holding her fast to the pact. His heart pounded. He had to close his eyes to control his ragged breath. True, there were all sorts of ways he could bludgeon her, with the diminished but still powerful husbandly prerogatives granted him under English law. But in the end, what would it accomplish? He recognized much of his younger self in her stubborn clinging to the idea of a good love, in her deep, sincere, if vastly misplaced sense of personal responsibility toward Lord Frederick. 10 years ago, she'd clearly perceived the ill suit between Theodora and himself, but she hadn't enough faith to let him discover it for himself. If he were to impregnate her with the express goal of keeping her bound in matrimony, he'd have made exactly the same mistake she had. "But what if she doesn't come to her senses, or doesn't come to her senses in time?" howled some primal part of him, all but trembling in angst. His entire person seized, recoiling in dread. That was a distinct possibility. He could not allow that to happen. He couldn't. His world would fall apart. Was this how she'd felt all those years ago? The anxiety, the simmering frustration, the corrosive fear that if he didn't do something, she'd be lost to him forever. Had he been 19, he'd have embarked on the same wrong path. At 31, even having lived through the aftermath of that debacle, he was still tempted almost beyond endurance. Only pride and his last shred of good sense saved him in the end. He wanted her to remain his wife not because he'd put an erotic spell over her, or because she loved her infant too much to give it up, but because she couldn't imagine her life otherwise, because she saw every breath she took intertwined with his, for better or for worse, in sickness and in health, for as long as they both should live. "As you wish," he said.
What? She couldn't have heard it right. She couldn't.
"Break open that bottle of champagne. This time next year, you could be Lady Philippa Stuart."
She didn't know why she should be so stunned. Yet she was dazed with distress, barely keeping herself together, as if all these weeks she'd been holding her breath, waiting for him to return and reclaim her, vowing never to let go of her again. He came close, too close for comfort, and sat down next to her, the light worsted wool of his summer trousers socializing insouciantly with the layers of her skirts. She became aware of the subtle scent of starch from his shirt, the spice and citron of his soap. A small part of her wanted to move away. The rest of her wanted him to trespass further, to push her down, hold her immobile, and do whatever he willed with her. He did something even more shocking.
He took her hand in his and said,
"I've been a cur, haven't I, coming here and subjecting you to this impossible situation?"
He played with her fingers absently, running the pad of an index finger against the inside of her knuckles. His hands were cool and faintly moist, as if he'd just washed and toweled them dry. The skin of his fingertips scraped her palm ever so slightly, reminding her that he did more than playing piano and rendering scaled drawings with those hands. She wanted to kiss his hand, every roughened finger pad, every knuckle. She wanted to suck on the ball of his thumb and lick the lines and wrinkles of his palm. If only she'd conceived. If only. If only. If only. She had desperately wanted it. With the relentlessness of garden weeds, she had wished it, dreamed it, desired it. It would have been an answered prayer, a clarion call, a catalyst around which all future courses of action would instantly crystallize. But it didn't happen.
"You'll be returning to New York City, then?" she said, careful not to choke.
"On the next steamer, I would imagine. My engineers are quite excited about the progress of our automobile. My accountants salivate at the investment opportunities, given the current upheaval in the stock market," he said, as if his departure had nothing to do with the end of their union. "If you're in the mood for acquiring some rail lines, you should come to the States end of this year or beginning of next."
"I will keep that in mind," she said numbly.
He rose. She stood up too.
"You'll need to watch out for fortune-hunting young ladies now," she said, wondering whether her awkward chuckle sufficiently hid her unhappiness.
"And title-hunting ones, too," he smiled, "and those who are simply dazzled by the way I walk and talk."
"Oh, yes, especially watch out for those. Don't cry, don't cry now."
Suddenly she realized that she was now the one holding on to him, not the other way around. He but allowed his hands to remain in her panicked grip. He was done. He'd said everything he wanted to say to her.
"Let go," she thought. "Let go, let go, let go."
When she at last did what she commanded, it was not through force of will. Her hands slackened and slid off his because it was not her place, nor her privilege, to touch him of her own volition.
"Goodbye, then," she said, "and a safe crossing."
"I wish you every happiness," he said, with grave formality. Then, with a swift peck to her cheek, "Parting is such sweet sorrow."
She didn't know what was so sweet about a sorrow that felt like her still-beating heart impaled upon the fangs of Cerberus. She could only watch hopelessly as he disappeared from her view, from her life. This time, for good.
Chapter 26. London, 25th of August.
"My dearest Philippa, I apologize for my letter arriving late yesterday. The light these past couple of days, though thinner and cooler than the light of high summer, has a wonderful golden quality, especially late in the day. Miss Carlyle thinks I've made tremendous progress on Afternoon in the Park. People are trickling back into London. Last night I had dinner at the Carlyles' and revealed myself a bounder when I admitted that I'd been in town for 2 weeks. Everyone else boasted that he'd spent the whole of August grousing in Scotland or sailing off the Isle of Wight. I'll be overjoyed to see you tomorrow. I wish we were already married. I enclose, as always, 1,000 loving thoughts. Yours ever devoted, Freddie."
Camden's departure had not gone unnoticed. Such was the newsworthiness of the event that within 36 hours the whole of London knew he'd vacated his apartment and taken everything with him. The telegraph, indeed the telephone, paled before the swiftness and efficacy of mouth-to-ear gossip transmission. What did it mean? Everyone had wanted to know.
Had Lady Tremaine won her battle? Had Lord Tremaine permanently withdrawn from the war? Or had he only temporarily retreated to regroup?
Gigi paltered, fudged, and equivocated, when she could. When pressed hard, she lied outright. She didn't know, she repeated. Lord Tremaine did not communicate personal plans to her. She didn't know what he intended. Didn't know. Didn't know. Didn't know. And therefore must curb her impatience just a bit longer.
The divorce papers were typed afresh, needing only her signature. She told the lawyers to sit on them. Goodman inquired whether the furniture and decor in Camden's bedchamber should be removed, covered, or polished daily in anticipation of his return. She had him leave everything alone. Her mother sent a fortune in telegrams. She ignored them en masse. But she couldn't ignore Freddy. Freddy, bless him for having been so patient, showed mounting signs of distress. "Is there anything from Lord Tremaine's solicitors?" he asked every time they met. "I wish we could get married right away." There was a fearful and almost frantic quality to his pleas. She gave the same carefully crafted answer each time, and hated herself with ever greater venom. Croesus was the only one who didn't pose questions she couldn't answer. But he looked dejected and listless in Camden's absence. She'd find him in the conservatory, napping on Camden's favourite rattan chair, the one with faded blue paisley cushions and cigar burns on the armrest, as if waiting for his return. Maintaining this intractable status quo was like juggling flaming scimitars. She woke up tired and went to bed dazed with fatigue, parrying a thousand acquaintances' curiosity, keeping her mother at arm's length, cosseting Freddy as best as she could, and withholding the truth even from her few trusted friends. The end of the season brought little relief. With rail travel as instantaneous as it had become, even her retreat to Briar Meadow provided no refuge. At the end of every week, she hosted a 3-day house party so that she and Freddy could see each other without any hint of impropriety. As a result, half of the time her house was swollen with people. Torrents of eager, unsatisfied inquisitiveness eddied and swirled, driving poor Freddy to distraction, and making her as cross as a stranded dowager with a bladder full of tea and no place to empty it. And guilt-ridden, and ashamed, and despondent. She knew what she was doing, of course. She was doing her damnedest to postpone the moment of reckoning, the moment when she must either step forth to marry Freddy, or at last face the fact that she could not even with Camden having completely removed himself from the melee. But how could she tell Freddy that? He'd been her faithful friend from the very first. Never, in all this chaos, had he blamed her, explicitly or implicitly, for anything. He had stood by her with courage and humility, enduring gossip that painted him as either a fool or a fortune hunter of the highest order. She owed him. He should be rewarded for his loyalty and his trust in her. He'd done so much for her, the steadfast Sancho Panza on her wild-eyed, quixotic quest. How could she do anything less for him? The brook was clear and shallow this time of the year. It murmured and soughed, with the occasional burble of a sunlit splash. The willows languidly trailed the tips of their soft branches on the surface of the stream, like a coy woman flaunting the luxuriance of her unbound hair with slow, teasing turns of her head. Gigi didn't know what she'd expected to find here. Camden flying down the hill like a Cossack and sweeping her up, perhaps. She shook her head, amazed at her own persistent idiocy. Still, she didn't leave. In 10 and a half years, she'd forgotten how pretty this spot could be, how quiet,
with no sounds except for the soft laughter of the brook, the rustle of the morning breeze as it skittered between leaves and branches, the lowing of sheep in the meadow behind her, grazing on a high green carpet of lucerne, and
hoofbeats?
Her heart ricocheted against her ribcage. The horse was coming from her own property. She whirled around, picked up her skirts, and sprinted up the slope. It was not Camden, but Freddy. Her surprise was almost stronger than her disappointment. She didn't even know Freddy could ride. He had an awkward seat, but hung on stubbornly, somehow zigzagging the horse forward on a prayer. She ran toward him.
"Freddy! Be careful, Freddy!"
She had to help him untangle his boot from the stirrup as he dismounted, the heel having caught on the way down.
"I'm fine, I'm fine," he reassured her hastily.
She glanced at her watch. Freddy usually arrived on the 2:13, but it was not even 11 o'clock yet.
"You're early. Is everything all right?"
"Everything is as it should be," he answered, as he inexpertly tethered the horse to a salt lick. "I didn't know what to do with myself, so I caught an earlier train. You don't mind?"
"No, no, of course not. You're always welcome here."
Poor Freddy. He'd become thinner each time she'd seen him. She felt a pinch in her heart. Her darling, how she wanted him to be happy. She kissed him on his cheek.
"Did you paint well yesterday?"
"I'm almost done with a picnic blanket."
"Good," she said, smiling a little to herself, enjoying his enthusiasm the way a parent enjoyed a child's.
"What about the items on the blanket? The picnic basket, that one remaining spoon, the half-eaten apple, and the open book?"
"You remember?"
Freddy looked to be in shock. So he'd noticed her preoccupation. She supposed it would have been too much to hope that he hadn't.
"Of course I remember,"
though only vaguely, and only because she'd asked him repeatedly.
"How are they coming along?"
"The book is giving me fits, half in the sun and half in the shade. I can't make up my mind whether the shadows should be tinged with ochre or viridian."
"What does Miss Carlyle think?"
"Viridian. That's why I'm not sure. I thought they'd be ochre."
He took a few steps in the direction of the stream.
"Are we still in Briar Meadow? I don't remember ever being this far from the house."
"That's Fairford land over there, beyond the water."
"Land that would have been yours one day."
She glanced at him, but caught only his profile.
"I've land enough."
Freddy sighed.
"What I meant was, if you and Lord Tremaine had not had your falling out, or if you'd managed to patch things up between the two of you.
Or if the 7th Duke had not died just before he was to marry me," she said. "Life does not proceed according to plans."
"But you probably don't very often wish that the 7th Duke hadn't died."
She opened her mouth to say something that would put his mind at ease, as she'd done innumerable times in recent months. But suddenly, the conceit and stupidity of it struck her. Freddy knew. Even if he hadn't acknowledged it, he understood that everything had changed. His anxiety could not be soothed away with mere words, nor eradicated even with a wedding ceremony. Like the phantom of a haunted house, it might recede into the woodwork when the sun was high and the day bright, only to return with a vengeance at the onset of long nights and howling storms. Her lack of a response hung heavy in the air. Freddy looked a little shocked. Like her, he'd probably become accustomed to the elaborate reassurances she manufactured with the efficacy of industrial processes. But she was a sham. The castle on the hill she'd built them was no more real than a painted fort on a stage backdrop. Freddy walked away from her, as if needing the distance to sort out his own thoughts. She could still coddle him, go on feigning that everything would be all right, but it would be an egregious lie.
It was a sad reflection on her arrogance, and naivety to some extent, that she remained convinced for so long that she could still make him happy, even if he couldn't do the same for her. There was no such thing as a marriage with one happy spouse. Both must be, or neither. She caught up with him at the edge of the meadow. "The light is good here," he said half-heartedly. He looked like something out of one of his beloved Impressionist paintings, a pensive, melancholy figure en plein air, against a brilliant sky and a verdant landscape. She pointed downstream. "See where the willows grow close to the bank? That's where I first met Lord Tremaine." Freddy scuffed the sole of his boot against an exposed rock.
"Love at first sight?"
"Close enough. Within 24 hours.
She took a deep breath and another. It was time to come clean. "In some ways, I was a victim of my youth and inexperience. I'd never been in love before, and I couldn't handle the intensity of my emotions. But mostly I was my own worst enemy. I was too selfish, too myopic, and too ruthless. I knew it was terrible to deceive him into thinking that his intended had already married someone else, but I went ahead and did it anyway." Freddy gasped. It was the first time she'd ever told him, or anyone, for that matter, what lay at the core of her marital infelicity. Little wonder. It was an ugly story, full of what she liked least about herself. "What I did brought me 3 weeks of happiness, rotten happiness at that, and then utter downfall." She sighed. "Life has its way of teaching humility to the arrogant."
"You are not arrogant," Freddy said stubbornly.
"Oh, Freddy, beloved Freddy. Perhaps not as much as I used to be, but still arrogant enough not to have informed you of the truth from the very beginning, about my marriage, about the paintings."
Freddy turned toward her.
"Do you really think I love you because you had certain paintings on your walls? I was already in love with you long before I ever set foot in your house."
She took his hands in hers, gazed at their linked fingers, and slowly shook her head.
"Alas, I'd hoped it was the paintings. That would make you and Miss Carlyle perfect for each other.
Angelica wants to make me into something I'm not. She wants me to be the next Fougereau, the most renowned artist of my day. But I'm not meant to be either famous or prolific. I'm a slow painter, and I don't mind it. I paint what I like and when I like, and I'd rather not second-guess whether a particular shadow is ochre or viridian."
She smiled ruefully.
"I can sympathize with that. Though I'd have wished that between you and Miss Carlyle..."
"I love you."
"And I adore you," she said, fully meaning every word. "I know of no better man than you. But should we marry, there'd be 3 of us in this marriage, always. That is not fair to you, and in time it would become intolerable. I've agonized about it day and night. You have been the dearest friend. I kept asking myself, how could I let you down? How could I hurt you? But I've come to see that I would completely betray your trust were I to continue this pretense that we could go on as if nothing has changed. Things have changed, and I can no more undo these changes than I can make water flow uphill. I can only be honest with you once and for all."
Freddy's head lowered.
"Do you still love him?"
The question that she'd once dreaded, that he hadn't dared to ask 6 weeks ago.
"Yes, I'm afraid. I don't know how I can apologize to you enough."
"You don't need to apologize to me for anything. You've never let me down, and you didn't this time either."
Freddy enfolded her in an embrace.
"Thank you."
She was befuddled. "Whatever for?"
"For liking me as I am. I never much cared for myself until you came along. You don't know how wonderful the past year and a half has been for me.
Dear Freddy, only he could be so sweet to thank her at a time like this. She hugged him back fiercely. You are the most wonderful person I've ever met, bar none.
When they let go of each other, his eyes were rimmed in red. She, too, had to fight the urge to cry, a sigh and a tear for something that wasn't meant to be, a lovely courtship that would have collapsed under the weight of a complicated marriage. Freddy was the first to speak.
You'll be going to America now, I guess.
She shrugged, trying to be nonchalant about it.
I don't know.
Camden had let her go with such ease and graciousness. He must have already come to the conclusion that he no longer wanted her, that the offer of reconciliation had been an aberration brought on by an emotional surge that could little withstand the force of reason. He would have gone on with his life already, taken a new lover or two, perhaps even begun to pay some mind to those beauteous young American misses being paraded before him, with their perfect American teeth and perfect American noses. Would he really want her to show up and spoil all his brand new plans?
Come, she placed her hand on Freddy's elbow. We'll walk back. It's time for lunch. My groom can get the horse later. Tell me what it is you'll do, now that you have declined to be the next great, world-renowned artist.
Gigi saw Freddy to the train station on Monday morning. She managed to have an agreeable time, conversing more frankly, affectionately, and easily with him than she'd been able to do in a long time. She even enjoyed her guests, once she took the plunge and informed them that, though she esteemed Freddy more than ever, she had deemed it prudent to release him from his commitment. When she arrived home, Goodman informed her that she had a caller waiting.
Mr. Addleshaw from Addleshaw Pearson Company is here to see you, milady. I have him in the library.
Addleshaw Pearson Company were Camden's solicitors. What was a senior partner doing paying her a visit far from the city? Addleshaw was in his early 50s, shortish and natty in his tweed suit. He smiled as Gigi entered the library, not the tight, cautious smile she'd have expected from a lawyer, but the delighted grin of a long-lost friend.
My Lady Tremaine,
he acknowledged her with a neat bow.
Mr. Addleshaw, what brought you all the way to Bedfordshire?
Business, I fear, though I confess, your ladyship, I've wanted to meet you in person ever since Mr. Burwald first contacted us with regard to the late Duke of Fairford.
Of course. How could she have forgotten? She had relentlessly driven Mr. Burwald, her head solicitor, against this very same Mr. Addleshaw, who had defended his client's interests with the ferocity of a mother lion. She smiled.
Am I quite as fearsome in person?
He didn't answer her question directly.
When Lord Tremaine informed me that he would marry you by special license, I'd half expected it. Unlike his late cousin, however, he was all but counting the days. I can see the reason now.
Ah, the sweet yesteryear. Her heart ached anew. She indicated a chair.
Please, have a seat.
Addleshaw produced a rectangular box from his briefcase and pushed it across the desk. The scent of rosewood, sweet and heady, wafted to her nostrils.
This came to our office last week by special courier. I ask that you please open it and verify that the contents have not been disturbed during the transit and my safekeeping.
What could Camden possibly want to give her? She drew a complete blank. Inside the wooden box lay a velvet jewellery case. She lifted its lid and lost her breath. Against a bed of cream satin sparkled a magnificent necklace, the chain of it done entirely in diamonds, one teardrop loop nestled against the next. 7 rubies, each surrounded by diamonds, dangled from the necklace. The smallest two, the size of her thumbnails, the largest one at the centre, bigger than a quail's egg. There were also two matching earbobs, each with a ruby as big as the pad of her index finger. She'd seen plenty of parure in her life. She owned a few gorgeous pieces herself. But even she rarely came across a set with such nerve and audacity. It would take a superbly self-assured woman to subsume its glitter in her own radiance, to not become a mere accessory to the necklace's splendour and costliness. There was a note, undated and unsigned, in Camden's slanted hand. The piano arrived in one piece, as out of tune as ever. Civility demands a return gift. I'd bought the necklace in Copenhagen. You might as well have it. In Copenhagen? He'd bought it for her.
Looks like everything's here, she mumbled.
Very good, ma'am, said Addleshaw. I am also to inform you that you may, at your pleasure, re-petition for divorce. Lord Tremaine has instructed us to stand aside and do nothing to impede its progress. The divorce should be a fairly straightforward legal matter at this point, as you have no children and no entanglement of properties that isn't already clearly spelled out in your wedding contract. For a moment, her heart stopped beating. He has withdrawn all objections? Yes, ma'am. Lord Tremaine stated his assent in a letter addressed to myself. I've brought the letter, if your ladyship would like to read it.
No, she said quickly, much too quickly. That will not be necessary. Your word is good enough.
She rose. The lawyer got to his feet also.
Thank you, ma'am. There is, however, one last small matter.
Gigi glanced at him, surprised. She thought their interview concluded already.
Yes, Mr. Addleshaw?
Lord Tremaine requests that you return to him one small item, a ring with filigree goldwork and an insignificant sapphire. She froze. Addleshaw had described her engagement ring.
I shall have to search for it, she said.
Addleshaw bowed.
Allow me to take leave of you now, Lady Tremaine.
The small sapphire glittered mutely as Gigi turned the ring between her fingers. Camden had bought it for her, and she'd been floored, not by the ring itself, but by him, by the overwhelming symbolic meaning of the gesture. He loved her. Her wedding ring she'd donated long ago to the charity for the houseless poor, but this ring she'd kept, out of sight, in a box that also contained the desiccated remains of all the flowers he'd ever brought her, and a faded length of blue ribbon that had once been a sweet, crushed bow on Croesus. Now he desired the ring back. Why revisit the most painfully sweet part of their past now? Why not demand that Croesus be returned too, while the poor old dog still had a breath left? Was he deliberately trying to provoke her? But what if he wasn't provoking her? What if he really just wanted the ring?